So, I saw this book advertised in Lion's Roar, which is the new, you know, Shambhala son. Forgotten Stories of Women in the Buddha's Life, Stars at Dawn. And I started reading it, and it's just so delightful to read. I just had such a great time reading this book. And like a lot of books that are nonfiction, biographical, etc., it actually engenders a lot of questions, as well as, you know, putting things out there. It actually begs a lot of questions, which I think is very interesting and helpful. And I know as an early student of the Vijayadharas, he was always telling us to question everything, but not with a skeptical kind of view, but with the view of trying to understand and develop, you know, some kind of insight and understanding as to what is, as opposed to just what people say. So no blind faith, but faith based on experience and insight. So these days, I think we still see a lot of patriarchal, you know, or what she calls, which I think is really good, androcentric. Androcentric means that it's geared to men, the male view of things. You know, and she says some of it is misogynist, which is, you know, hating women. But a lot of it is not because of hating women, but because of the cultural bent on making, you know, men the sort of leaders. But, you know, these days there are a lot of women who are holding important positions, you know? There are women Episcopal priests. There are women Roshis, Rinpoches. There are rabbis. In our community, there's a lot more women than when I was, you know, starting out practicing. A lot more women in positions of importance. I mean, some of us were here a couple of weeks ago when Acharya Azrael was here, obviously, Melanie Klein, for instance, as the director of the Boulder Shambhala Center. So, you know, things may be changing a bit, but I think, you know, we all agree that the androcentric emphasis is still, you know, alive and well. So what she says is that through the years, certain stories and histories have taken root and were not questioned. Partly that's because the early translators were missionaries and Sanskrit scholars and Pali scholars who were Catholics. But through her research, which is extensive, and other people really looking closely at very early texts, and they find we find that there's more than one side to these stories. And her research is quite remarkable. She has 10 primary sources and hundreds of other sources. But out of the 10 primary sources, only 4 of them were published after 1900. A lot of her sources are from the 1800s, which is very interesting.
Did you tell us who she was?
Who she is?
Yeah.
Wendy Garling. Okay. And it doesn't really say that much about her. She says things like she took refuge with the 16th Karmapa, but I think she's a Galupa because she's a student of some of the Galupa teachers. She went to the University of California, Berkeley, and various other schools. But she doesn't really say that much about herself. And I don't know what else she's written. One of the very fascinating things about this book is that besides the fact that it brings out all these stories, forgotten stories, as she says, of women at the time of the Buddha's life, it is a wonderfully complete biography of the Buddha. It's a more extensive biography of the Buddha than I think I have read before, which is very nice in itself. Because like a lot of heroes, like the Buddha, like Jesus, like others, we know about their birth, right? We know about a little bit about, we know what happened when they got to be like in their 20s and they left home, and we know something about whatever their enlightenment was, and we know about their death. But we don't really know, there isn't a lot about what happened between birth and leaving home. And she goes into that quite extensively here. And also, she gives stories that are three or four-fold in style. One style of telling a story in a spiritual context is what's called a hagiography. It's a biography of the saints, is what it means. And it's a biography that is spiritual in the sense that it's not necessarily the kind of biography that you might read about somebody that we know. Like if you read the biography of Abraham Lincoln, you're not going to get a lot of, you know, gods and goddesses that came and visited him, and, you know, when his mother died, he came and visited her. She came and visited him many times. You're not going to get the kind of stories that she tells in here, for instance, about the Buddha's conception, which, according to these stories, was an immaculate conception. Where she was surrounded by only with women for about 32 months before she conceived, before she had the dream of a white elephant. And there's just all kinds of interesting things like that. Gods and goddesses that attended her and him. All kinds of magical things that happen. And then there is the sort of conventional biography. So, for instance, and I'm going to read you some excerpts because it's fun, but just to give you some, you know, outline here. For the Buddha's mother, Maya, her name is. And the story kind of goes that she had a prophecy that she was going to give birth to a very important being, and that after she gave birth to him, she wouldn't live very long. And in fact, she died maybe a couple of days after he was born. And she never had any children before him, the Buddha, and of course never after. Some of the biographies is that she had this, had been given this prophecy that she was going to die. And there's also the story of the Buddha, many of you know, that have seen that he wasn't born through her vaginal canal, but he came out of her side. So she talks about how, if we looked at it in a conventional sense, it's very possible that she might have had a cesarean, because in those days they did do cesareans. I don't know how much, you know, sterilization and stuff they had.
Could give rise to dying 2 days afterwards.
And so, yeah, the point is that a lot of women died in childbirth at that time.
They probably did as good a job as we do.
Maybe. So there's a lot of this kind of thing, which I think is just fascinating. I think it's great to hear the hagiography, and I also think it's good to think about things like when she talks about. Many of you are probably familiar with the general sense of the life of the Buddha. Mm-hmm. You know, it says in the biographies that we're used to that his father made sure that he didn't see anybody dying and he didn't see anybody who was sick and he never left the palace. Although, you know, she says there's some evidence that he actually went to a university, the Buddha. And she also makes the point that two things about his mother, Maya. One is that she makes the point that it could be very well be that having lost his biological mother was a very traumatic thing for him. And if you any of you lost a parent when you were quite young or didn't know if you were adopted and wondered, you know, there's some evidence, she said, that wound was what was somewhat of his impetus for exploring more about the world. Because, you know, she says, in the typical biographies, they say he never saw a dead person or never heard about a dead person, but his mother died. He knew that. His stepmother, who was also his biological mother's sister and was the Buddha's father's co-wife or second wife, became his mother. Anyway, it's kind of fascinating. So I wanted to read some things here, if you will indulge me. The parable generally goes like this. The Buddha was born in Lumbini in present-day Nepal. His mother Maya died within days of his birth. The court Brahmins predicted that the child would turn out to be either a great king or a holy man. His father, king of Shakras, would determine that his son would be his successor, thus surrounded the prince with every possible luxury, etc., etc. Where was that thing I was going to read? So there are various different stories about where these things came from. The stories that emerged from India, Buddhism heartland, flowed across Asia with the spread of Buddhism. To the northeast, one tradition traveled through Nepal, across the Himalayas to Tibet, while another spread to China and farther east to Korea and Japan. To the south, a tradition in Sri Lanka, Burma, Thailand, Southeast Asia. It was initially recorded in Sanskrit, Pali, Sinhalese, and a whole bunch of other languages. So, as we know, things that get translated into different languages and to different cultures don't always maintain their original. It's like playing the telephone game. You know, somebody from India travels to wherever, and, you know, it's like Because then things weren't written down, everything was oral, which to us, we have to understand that since nothing was written down, everything was oral, remembering things became very important. And they would write things in verse, right? Because it's easier to remember verse, easier to remember a poem than it is, right? Than it is like a paragraph in a book. But still, partially because of the androcentric bent, and partially because people didn't remember things, stories got strangely interpreted. So here is some stories about the birth. Maya is remembered as a beautiful young queen who gave birth to the Buddha in the lush woodland of Lubini's Grove, surrounded by women, including her sister Mahaprajapati, and clanswomen from her village who arrived to assist with the birth. Maya had always intended to deliver in Lumbini's Grove, taking leave of her husband to travel there in the full bloom of pregnancy, accompanied by her female attendants, as this was a sacred place of protection for women in childbirth. One thing about going to her father's place rather than having her baby with her husband is this was very traditional. When you were pregnant, you went to your parents' home to have your baby, and your mother took care of the arranging for the birth and everything. And Lumbini was near her parents. But again, it was a sacred place of women. It still is, actually. On arrival, as the pangs of labor overcame her, she sought refuge under a magnificent shala tree, whose indwelling goddess, I think it was Ashita, lowered her boughs in recognition that the time of the birth had come. Grasping a branch with her raised right hand, Maya, who was standing with her sister, gently supporting her, delivered her only child, a son whose destiny was to cast a brilliant light into the darkness of human suffering. As the infant Buddha's life began in this sublime setting, delivered into the hands of women, so Maya's life sadly ended. The stories are consistent that she died in childbirth. However, the Buddha's birth story usually isn't told this way. In the traditional account, his mother gave birth surrounded by Brahmanical gods, all male, anxiously awaiting the delivery of the exalted child, with no mention at all of women or a goddess being present. It was entirely random that Maya gave birth in Lumbini, as the grove was just a stopping point along the route she was traveling at the behest of her husband to reach her father's home. Rather than insinuate details of midwifery or natural birth, the traditional account relates that the infant was delivered miraculously and immaculately from Maya's right side into a golden net held by the god Brahma. Although uninjured by this method, she died inexplicably 7 days later. So, interesting. Interesting that,
Tosadara is the wife of Buddha.
Yashodhara, yes.
And she was trained as well as the Buddha.
Yes.
And she could have become the Buddha if she had been a male.
Well, there's a lot of questions about
that. She led the women.
Yes, I'm going to get to that.
Oh, okay.
I'm going to get to that.
You're ahead of
her. Yeah, I'm going to get to that. So, and the other thing that was very interesting, I'm not going to read the whole thing, but the story that, so that story that I told, the first part that I read, had a kind of combination of the sublime and the mundane, right? She's going to Lubini's, and then this goddess helps her, And there's a lot of stories about that. And the real elaborate story that is told about Maya is that at a certain point she had a dream that a white elephant was going to enter her womb and that that would be the Buddha, and that she decided at that point, she told her husband, I have to go into seclusion with only women, you know, and you can have some protector men on the outside, but only women, and you must not have any desire for me. And so she did that. She went into seclusion with her hundreds of women, and she was in seclusion for quite a long time, months and months and months, before she actually had the dream again that the elephant entered her womb. And then she found out she was pregnant. And apparently the baby that entered her womb was the size of a six-month-old that sat up throughout the entire 10 months, by the way, Buddhas gestate for 10 months, not nine, sat up for the entire time and then emerged from her side. And the question, and he even gave teachings from the womb, apparently, in some of these stories. And the question arose, well, if he was able to do that, why did he need to, a woman? You know, why did he need to be born of a woman, you know? And the answer was that he had to be a human. The Buddha is a human being. And he had to be born in of a woman in order to, you know, complete the karma of being a human and being, you know, an example for people. Because if he had been just an avatar, then we wouldn't be able to say that all of us could become Buddhists.
I was thinking, what if he was just a white elephant?
So that's a very interesting stories, and it's just wonderfully also, as many of us know, those of us who have studied some Buddhism, in the Mahayana tradition, the best example of compassion is the mother, right? Because the mother carries you. And it is said that Maya was the inspiration for that because she carried him for 10 months and died after he was born. But supposedly she watched over him from a celestial realm his whole life and advised him. And they were reunited after he died. But she was a presence in his life always. Watching over her only son. And she gave her life for him, knowing, you know, supposedly knowing that she would die. So that's... So he grows up... it's already late. He grows up, and there's lots of stories about that. What's very interesting is that at the time, men had many wives, and they even had an entire harem full of women. And the women raised the children, and that was their responsibility. And the children all played together, and so since Suddhodana was his father, he fathered quite a number of children with his harem, and so they all grew up together. But from the very beginning, and this again is hard to say whether this was a hagiography or this real actually happened, but from the very beginning, Buddha was recognized. Siddhartha was recognized as, you know, a Buddha. And people bowed down to his feet. All of the children, all of the women recognized. And it was said that when he met somebody, he immediately put his feet out to indicate that they should bow, not because he was arrogant, but because if you didn't bow down to the Buddha, if you wanted him to bow to you, your head would split in 7 pieces. Mm-hmm. So he didn't want that to happen to anybody. Anyway, it's really fun. It's really fun to read. So he grows up in the harem, and eventually, when he's like 16 or something, he meets his primary wife, who's Yashodhara, and then there's Megiri Gautami, who is his second wife. But Yashodhara was very important. She was somewhat rebellious. She didn't necessarily want to go along with what was asked of her. So, for instance, women are supposed to cover themselves up. So, as a principal consort, she's being, you know, tested to see if she has all of the things that you need to have, which is interesting because the Buddha's not really, he doesn't care whether you're high caste or low caste, but you have to be somebody with good qualities, truthfulness, and righteousness. So she says, since I have all these suitable qualities, may this handsome and gentle prince be my husband. If he consents, there should be no delay, or I will end up with an inferior ordinary man. So, harem protocol apparently requires that women veil their faces. Yashodhara refuses to do this to the dismay of both her parents, in-laws, and other harem women. She did not cover her face, so people criticized her and spoke badly, saying, a new wife is supposed to be covered. Responding to their criticism, she squares off in front of everyone in wise, elegant verse, reprimands them for the shallowness of their thinking. A noble being shines when uncovered, when sitting, standing, or walking like a precious gem beaming, radiant on the pinnacle of a standard. A noble one without evil shines perpetually, whereas an immature being who commits evil never shines, no matter what she wears. And it goes on and on, but you get the point. She was feisty. And he liked that. He very much he enjoyed that. And yes, she was very well educated. She was... and he had other wives, and he had a whole harem, and... You know, his father tried to fill up his harem with beautiful women and made sure that he had all of the luxuries and everything, so he wouldn't want to leave. But he had this nagging thing about he just wasn't, and there were the various signs, etc. So there's a lot to read about, but I. So at a certain point, he leaves, which is, obviously very upsetting to everybody. And he goes off and he studies with various different ascetics. And he enjoys being with them, but he finds that there's something lacking in every one of them, and so he decides that he's going to go off and be a solitary person. So he goes off and he sits under the Bodhi tree, which again, the religion at the time, main religion, like in for the Shakyas, which is what the Buddha's family was a goddess religion. And so all of the forests and all of the trees, and it was very elemental, and they all had goddesses. And so the trees And if anybody has done the Sadhana Mahamudra, that would sound familiar, right? The water which flows here is the Buddha Mamaki, who is the lake of mirror-like wisdom, clear and pure. All the mountains are Buddha Lachana, who is all-pervading wisdom of equanimity and unchanging stillness. In the terrifying trees are protecting Mahakalis. Rangjung Gelma, who is a very important protector for the Karmapas, Dorje's, you know, et cetera, et cetera. So this, you know, continues. So that's an interesting thing. But what I want to skip to because of the time is what we're very interested in is what happened to the women after he leaves. So he goes off and he starts his ministry. And word travels of him. You know, people see him and they want to be with him. They want to become ordained to be, you know, monastic like him. And so his monastery, his palace empties out of men. I mean, they leave. They leave to go off and to become the students of the Buddha, leaving the women to fend for themselves. And remember, they don't necessarily have the skills to know how to do these things. And at the same time, they started to wonder, why can't we do this? Why is it that only men can do this? And under the leadership of the Buddha's mother, his adopted mother, Mahaprajapatiya, once her husband, Shudahana, the Buddha's father, dies, the women get together and they decide to beseech the Buddha for ordination. But there's a lot of, you know, obviously there's a lot of question about at the time whether women could be enlightened or whether they could, you know. But what's very interesting here is this beautiful passage from the Sinhalese tradition of what the women gave up in order to go find the Buddha. So this is just beautiful. Previously, the women had thought it a great thing to have to descend from the upper to the lower story of the palace. They were only accustomed to walk in places so smooth that they were like mirrors that reflected the image of all things near them. For the fuel in the palace, when fires were required on account of cold, they had only burnt cotton and silk cloth smeared with oil, as common wood would have caused too much heat and sandalwood too much smoke. Even when they went out to the bath, they were protected by curtains and canopies, and in every respect they were brought up in the most delicate manner. It took Mahaprajapati and her company several months to walk the more than 400 kilometers to Vaishali, where the Buddha was residing. Needless to say, they became exhausted and filthy, their bare feet swollen and blistered. Kind-hearted villagers along the way offered them food, litters for transport, and other means of assistance. But the women resolutely refused. They finally catch up with the Buddha. And when Ananda, who was one of the Buddha's main disciples, as you know, he was also his half-brother. He was the son of Mahaprajapati. When Ananda saw them with bleeding feet covered with dust and half dead, his breast was full of sorrow and his eyes filled with tears, and he said, "Why have you come?" And they say that they want to become ordained. So then there's a lot of stuff that... There are several key elements surrounding the Buddha's ambivalence in ordinating women. His initial hesitation, his declaration that women and men are equally capable of achieving complete realization, and the 8 extra rules. So, this is interesting. The Buddha was enlightened, right? Enlightened people have no bias. Otherwise, they would have conditioned minds. And he didn't. However, what the point that she makes is there was a lot of, you know, dissension and can women do this and everything. But another point that she makes, which I think is somewhat convincing, is that all of a sudden 500 women show up. And he has to figure out how to feed them, how to clothe them, how to house them, and how to protect them. And she says that there are certain stories that say that it was the practicalities of how to deal with this that was the impetus for his hesitation, rather than thinking that women couldn't do it. And eventually, of course, he does ordain them, and they all do very well. And there are stories like where did this idea that, for instance, women are inferior to men, their bodies are inferior. Well, there's one story in here that the Buddha was talking to one of his female disciples, and he was giving her the instruction on contemplating the body as impermanent, and that, you know, that it had these orifices and it has these secretions, and, you know, really this is one of the early Hinayana things, right? That you contemplate the nastiness of the body, and why would you cling to this, and why would you have any desire for somebody else's? And one of the monks heard this, and he thought that the Buddha was talking to this woman, meaning women, and he spread the rumor that the Buddha had said that women were vile, when in fact, later on, he gave the teaching, that teaching, to all the monks and nuns. So, in the end, when he dies, okay. In the end, Maya shows up. His mother is the last to pay homage to the Buddha. From heaven, she hears of her son's death and, arriving at his coffin, faints from emotion. Revived by her celestial maiden attendants, she approaches the coffin, lamenting sorrowfully, tenderly touching his robe, bowl, and staff, which are lying nearby. At that moment, the lid miraculously opens and light bursts forth as the Buddha sits up. Maya and her son are reunited briefly for the last time. The Buddha praises her as a woman and a mother, then comforts her with a teaching that his passing away is in harmony with the natural law. So Maya is the last among all the Buddha's disciples to receive his earthly blessing. Anyway, there are many, many stories in here that obviously I couldn't go through, but I hope that this gave you a taste.
What's the name of the book again?
Stars at Dawn, Forgotten Stories of Women in the Buddha's Life by Wendy Garling.
Stars at Dawn.
Yeah. I actually wrote it wrong in the announcement. I said Wendy Garland. It's Wendy Garling. So we have a few minutes if anybody would like to. And by the way, I just wanted to say one thing. It's mentioned about the 8 extra rules for the nuns. And this was very controversial because they thought that it was you know, that he was saying that women couldn't, you know, had to bow down to monks and all these other kinds of things. But in other places, I have heard, and particularly from Anne Waldman, who some of you may know, mm-hmm. she's a poet who is a core teacher at Naropa. Her research said that some of the laws related with menstruation, because as many of you probably know, in agrarian cultures in particular, and even in Native American cultures today, when women are menstruating, they have to go off somewhere. So there were laws about that. But the interesting thing that Anne said was that when the women showed up, the Buddha was afraid that people were going to fall into their old habits of the women serving the men, not necessarily sexually, but sewing their robes and cleaning their stuff. Realizing that he made these rules. A nun may not touch a monk's robe. Well, if you can't touch it, you can't sew it. And a nun may not touch a monk's bowl. So if you can't touch it, you can't wash it. So he actually, according to Anne, these rules were for the protection of the nuns to maintain the integrity of their vows, which is not in this book, but I think as an aside, it's an interesting thing. So, yes, Yashodhara was an amazing person.
I think she was.
Yeah, they all were. His stepmother, his wives. I mean, you can just see the resolve. They decided, you know. And after the women left, whoever was left in the kingdom there, they were conquered by the Kosalas. And that was the end of that particular kingdom.
Many women became enlightened.
Yes.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yes, many women became enlightened.
One thing that's really interesting to me is, you know, you kept touching on these points of, you know, this birth out of the side and, you know, the sitting up in the tomb mm-hmm. or whatever. You know, there's so much of that that's reflected in the Christian story.
I know.
So found that kind of interesting.
It's very interesting mm-hmm. that when you look at this kind of stuff, these hagiographies, and you begin to look at their stories in other religions, you begin to see, you know, and nobody wants to, you know, criticize or be, you know, but you begin to see, for instance, and I think she talks about that Eve, for instance, was demonized, you know, she was the evil one because she took the, right, she took mm-hmm. the apple from the snake, right? Mm-hmm. Mary had a immaculate conception mm-hmm. and she was a virgin. Now, obviously, Maya was not a virgin, mm-hmm. but as Wendy Garland makes the point in Buddhism, virginity and chastity, except for nuns, is not necessarily, what shall I say, not encouraged. It wasn't like revered. That was the word she used. It wasn't revered. Virginity and chastity was not revered. So that's why Maya had to go off and spend many months before she became pregnant to make the point that... Yes, it does. It points up, like, so what do we make of these other stories?
Mm-hmm. It seems like there's certain human traits that would just, like, if you want to boost the reputation of someone, there's sort of, like, certain traits that transcend all cultures that mm-hmm. they're just natural things to go to, like the intelligence of a child or, like, the early development of a child. And, you know, those... It's almost impossible that any of the histories of any, you know, of Jesus, of Buddha, whoever, it's almost impossible that they wouldn't be boosted up that stories wouldn't, you know, that exaggerations wouldn't happen. Like, mm-hmm. I can't imagine that they wouldn't, you know. So it seems like, you know, like with him sitting up at an early age or teaching from an early age, it just seems like a very obvious thing that would get exaggerated right away just to boost up that reputation. You
know? Right, and that he had the 32 marks of a Buddha. You ever hear about that? His skin was very clear. His hands and feet had webbing of light, you know, between the fingers and toes. And there was like, there's 32 of them. I don't remember all of them.
And he, like, he still went through it, right? Like,
yes.
He still suffered. And so, like, he was born, like, I don't believe that he was born fully enlightened and giving teachings, because throughout his life he had to figure out so many things. He still had to go through the things that we all go through.
Right.
He did it really well and quickly became Buddha, but it doesn't make sense that he was like, because, you know, because he suffered.
Right, and I think that, I mean, that's a really excellent point, and I think part of it is that, I don't know if part of it is revisionist history, or whether it's, you know, that his birth was prophesied and that he had that karma, you know, like, for instance, people will say, well, like these tulkus, mm-hmm. like the Dalai Lama or the Vajrayana mm-hmm. or any of them, you know, if they died and they were enlightened, then why, they have to go through the whole thing.
Yeah.
They have to go through the whole thing.
The Dalai Lama says, like, he, you know, it says when people ask him if he's enlightened, he says, well, I'm here. Like, you know, I'm not enlightened because I'm here. You know, how could I be?
Mm-hmm.
Maybe it's real close, you know, but if you're taking a human form, you're not yet enlightened.
Right, because the Buddha says that when he's born, he says that's his last birth. This is his last birth.
It's also interesting to me that, you know, we have heard over and over again that in his early life, the Buddha did not experience any suffering. You know, he was kept clear of that. But as you said, it's so obvious. I mean, it's very obvious. If you're having the human experience and your mother dies, you're suffering, right, at the beginning, from the very beginning. So there's a mythology around that.
That's right. That's right. His father tried to set it up so that he wouldn't. But, I mean, you can't imagine that. A child, somebody got to be the age of 30 and never was sick, or, you know, especially in that time period, or never saw a sick person, never saw anybody died. I mean, he had grandparents, and so it's more symbolic in the sense that, at least this is my take, and when I've studied these things, my take is it wasn't so much that he had never seen somebody who was old and dying, but it was the sort of insight or revelation of what that meant.
The awakening, kind of.
The awakening of, like, what it meant to for somebody to be dying, or for some, you know, the it hit him in such a powerful way. It wasn't like he had never seen that, but he had never really experienced, you know, the what that really means, what it really means to die or to be that sick. So, yeah, go ahead, Lee.
It's a huge metaphor for our modern society, because his dad gave him entertainment. That's what he did. He kept him entertained.
Yeah.
He gave him girls, and he gave him parties, and he gave him sports, and he gave him all this stuff. And that's our society, you know, like, don't think about death. Here's all this stuff to keep him occupied, you know. And then all of a sudden he was like, wait, this stuff's not making me happy. What's going on? I'm going to die, and everyone's dying. And, you know, but that's all his dad did, was flooding with entertainment.
It's interesting you say that, because I was thinking the same thing, that it's like they planted him in front of a TV set or something for his childhood, and you watch the commercials.
And all he watched was Sesame Street.
That's like, and then he grew up, and he suddenly see, you know, crap, you know, there's like real problems in the world, and you just don't know that before. You know?
Yeah, well, he was very protected in the harem. That's for sure. But as I said, and there are other books out there. I wish I could remember the name of the book that I read at the Nadon School, but it was by this English couple, David and Indira somebody. But they wrote The Life of the Buddha as if he was an ordinary person. He went, you know, all of his friends went to school outside the palace, and his parents wanted him to be tutored because they didn't want him, you know. So there's all kinds of things like that that are kind of fascinating.
I just wanted to touch on one other thing also, and I can't remember who I heard this from, but there is a theory that right around the time of the life of the Buddha was part of the transition from the ancient cultures, which were primarily matriarchal, run by women. And this is around the time the men started to take over. And so they were very threatened by women, you know, and they were very careful.
In their place.
Yeah, yeah. But I mean, in the old days, it was really women who more common for them to run things. Mm-hmm. And it was only around this time that men came in and took over and have held that position ever since.
And things went downhill from there.
Yeah, yes. What a great job we did.
I think that goes along so well, too, with wealth. Because there's not only a story of gender there's a story of class.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And, like, men had multiple wives, but the men that could afford multiple wives, right? And so there were these ancient cultures that were matriarchal and closer to the earth and closer to reality. And that's when wealth started to accumulate, and it was men that collected the wealth and then, you know, started to collect all the stuff, and then they were in charge, and they got away from that way of knowing, you know, because I think Buddha said that, you know, there was a time when people didn't need to meditate, right? There was a time when we were still connected with the universe, you know, and then there was this disconnect, and then that's at the same time that the patriarchal society really gained strength and the accumulation of wealth. And then Jesus and Buddha and Muhammad and all these great teachers came along.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Well, you know, before the Buddha was born, as the story goes, he was in Tushita heaven, which is a sort of green room, right, for the Buddhas who are waiting. And he was waiting for certain conditions to be in effect before he was going to come and be born. And one of the conditions was that lifespan was down to a maximum of 100 years. And that in these previous eons, people had lived very, very long. And you can see this in the Bible. You know, Methuselah lived 900 years, and Sarah was 90 when she gave birth to, who was it? Was it Isaac? Yeah. So he was waiting for, but on the other hand, then when he becomes enlightened, it becomes it's very easy for his disciples to become enlightened. Because, and I asked Igor Khonsho Rinpoche about this once, I said, you know, why was it that all of his disciples went off and became enlightened, you know, or became very highly realized anyway? And, you know, these days we just don't see that. And he said, well, because at the time of the Buddha's enlightenment, the merit of being at that around that time and being around him was so great that it was easy to attain enlightenment. These days, we don't have that kind of... He said that merit started to deteriorate somewhat after the life of Milarepa. So that was like, 1100 or something? So right around then, he said, things start to deteriorate. And at this point, we don't have the conditions that are conducive, really, for people to attain enlightenment easily, or if at all. So anyway, it's a couple of minutes to 9. And this is a discussion that could continue in some other some other way at some other time, because I think it's fascinating.
It's sort of an ongoing issue within. I mean, that's why people like Rita Gross and a lot of people put a lot of energy into exploring more what the place of the woman had been in Buddhist history and
what reality was. Like, what really happened?
Yeah, yeah, as if we know. And, you know, it begs the question at the end. It begs the question that I started with in the beginning. Is like, what do you trust?
Right.
You know? Mm-hmm. What we don't know what actually happened. Mm-hmm. We don't know. No, these people were a lot closer to the earth than we were. So if you're closer to the earth, then things do have a kind of more magical quality in a way. You are more in tune with nature. And it's like what we're doing, say, in the Shambhala tradition with bringing down the dralas, mm-hmm. trying to get more connected to, you know, the elemental energies that we can harness and use, that we've sort of lost contact with.
Mm-hmm. And that, for, in some ways, you can trust. You can mm-hmm. trust those
yeah.
beyond stories.
Right.
Well, right, because you have to imagine if 500 women really traveled a huge distance and they didn't know how to hunt and they didn't, you know, that there had to be some magical connection to, we can eat this. We know, you know, we're being guided in some way by the drums. Mm-hmm.
Especially if they've been living in palaces.
Exactly, exactly.
And served and everything. Yeah.
Connection to the natural world in some magical form. Goddesses giving, like you said, with the tree, the goddess saying...
That doesn't happen in Boulder Community Hospital.
No. And there are a number of stories in here about that kind of phenomena. At one time, the Buddha, when he was a little boy, he was a baby, and they were at some sort of festival or something, can't remember, and he was being taken care of by 100 women, but they forgot about him. And so he was under this tree, and the sun moved, right? So mm-hmm. he didn't have any shade, but the tree, the yakshi in the tree, mm-hmm. bent down to make sure that he wouldn't get burnt by the sun, and then they found him.
There's a place out in the Red Desert, which is the Red Desert in the Great Basin. It's south of Lander, south of South Pass, Wyoming. Really fabulous place, but the Comanche lived there for a long time. And then the Shoshone and the Arapaho after that. But there's a place where the story is almost all women tried to give birth, and men weren't allowed there. Now they are. I've been there. And it's the birthing rock, and they gave birth standing up, mm-hmm. and there's handprints, mm-hmm. and you can put your hands in it. And I never have. A friend of mine, a native friend of mine, said that's not, it's like men shouldn't go there, it's not for men. But there was something about that place, mm-hmm. you know, that it wasn't just coincidence, you know, it wasn't just like, oh, this is the place you have babies. You know, they knew there was something there that allowed, you know, birth to be more successful or whatever. And it's so old that, I mean, the handprints are there. I mean, you can. Mm. Where they held on.
Well, apparently King Ashoka went to Lumbini's Grove, where the Buddha was born, and made all kinds of offerings. You know, thousands of gold pieces and some archaeological group went there, and they uncovered a number of things. I forgot what they were, she says in the book. But, there are places, I mean... There are power spots. And that's what's so interesting about one of the interesting things about the difference between the women's story about her giving birth at Lumbini as a sacred place of women, and the man's story about it would just happen. She just happened to go into labor there, you know.
She just happened to, fully pregnant, try to walk to the place.
Yeah. All right. Well, maybe we should close. This has been a very good discussion. I hope that this was interesting.
Mm-hmm. I don't think I myself have ever any studied that at all, so I only know like Siddhartha. Mm-hmm. This story is the basic story. So this is really all kind of new to me.
Yeah, well, I love this book. I really love it. It's fun to read. It's like I said, it's well written, and it's not scholarly or dry, and she does bring in all these other things. So if you're interested.
Yeah, definitely. Could be a lot more discussion.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, it's rich. Every page is very rich with things. By this merit, may all attain admissions, may it defeat the enemy wrongdoing, from this army raised of birth, old age, sickness, and death.